Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in China and England, and was a freelance reporter for the BBC. In 1984, he came to America and became a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and then a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is the co-founder of the Trinity Forum and has written and or edited 30 books. A leader of leaders, a thought leader, his name, Oz Guinness. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're with Oz Guinness, who co-founded the Trinity Forum with Alonzo McDonald in 1991. Oz, a welcome, a real honor to have you.
Well, great privilege to be with you, Jack. Thank you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Well, I was born in China. My parents were married in 1938, just as the war with Japan was breaking out, which was earlier, of course, than Europe. And it was a rather horrendous first few years for me. We were living in the part of China where the communist troops were above us and the Japanese troops on the other side, and they had killed 17 million in their invasion. And we were supposedly protected by the nationalists, but they didn't seem to care too much. And at one horrendous time, we found ourselves in Henan in a famine in which 5 million died in 3 months. And my brothers died. I nearly died. My mother nearly died. My mother was a doctor, but there's no food, no medicine. So it was an extraordinary time, although, of course, I was too young to remember it. But I've heard the stories from my parents and have seen a film about it with the human river of misery, with 10 million people on the road as refugees trying to find food and water and so on. So I grew up in horrendous circumstances in my earliest years, although, as I said, I don't remember that part.
After 8 years, you moved to England with your parents. Tell us about your 25 years living in England.
Well, before that, I should just say that the part I do remember in China, we lived in what was then Nanking. And I remember the day in January 1949 when my dad said to me, "Son, we're in trouble. Chiang Kai-shek has just flown to Formosa, Taiwan. And we're left at the mercy of the communist troops." And sure enough, 3 months later, in May 1949, they marched in and took over, and the reign of terror began. So I was there a couple of years in under house arrest with my parents, and they were kept another 3 years by the communists. So I well remember that part and the sense of fear and the beginning of the repression. Then I got back to England and went to school in Kent, and then to the University of London. And that was in the middle of the so-called swinging London, the rise of the counterculture, films like Bergman's, Fellini, Antonioni, very, very extraordinary times. And in the beginning of that, I came to faith, but found that time incredibly challenging but wonderful, really challenged to think back the roots of why I believed what I believed and so on.
During your time in England, you got to meet with Winston Churchill. Tell us about Winston Churchill.
That was very, very brief. And one of my best friends lived in Westerham in Kent, which is the little town closest to Chartwell, which was Churchill's home. And one day the great man was walking through the town village, and along with a few others, I happened to shake hands with him. But I certainly grew up remembering his speeches and knowing his great leadership when he came back into power in 1951. So Churchill's always been one of my greatest heroes, and I've got his autograph and a photograph of him flashing his famous V sign on the walls behind me among some of my writing heroes.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Churchill?
Gosh, a lot of things. On the one hand, his incredible courage. But also, I would say, his immense sense of history. As Churchill often said, the further back you can look, the further ahead you can see. And he knew every speech had a great sense of the historical setting in which it was given, but also of the background. And you don't see that much today when speeches are written by ghostwriters and so on. Very few American leaders today have a great sense of history, as Churchill did. And I think that's a great weakness of ours.
Oz, you're the great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the Dublin brewer and founder of Guinness Beer. Can you tell us a beer story?
Well, my ancestor actually came to faith through the preaching of John Wesley on one of his tours in Ireland. And from the very beginning of the brewery, he built in generosity and built in what we now call corporate social responsibility. So healthcare, education, sports, all housing, all sorts of things for the workers. And he was always Ireland's most generous boss. But you can see that spilled out to much wider philanthropy. Actually, they did things believing the words of Jesus, you don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. So there are funny stories that come out of that, too. One of my ancestors was asked to rebuild St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is the largest church in Ireland, but it was flooded annually and almost falling down. And he did so long as they didn't mention the family involvement. But they did such a good job that they said, would he mind if there was a discreet thank you? And reluctantly, he said yes. Although, when the curtains went back on a stained glass window dedicated to the family, you can see this today as tourists, the biblical verse, the Bible verse the city fathers put at the bottom was, I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink, which has been a sort of tourist amusement ever since.
Can you tell us the story about the night that the heads of the major brewery families got together?
Well, that, I always enjoy that story, but I have to say that one's purely fictional. There was a so-called brewing convention. At the end of it, they all got together for a drink, and Augie Bush ordered a Bud. Pete Coors, who's a great friend of mine, ordered his signature drink, which is Coors Light. And as the story goes, they came round to the chairman of Guinness, and he ordered a Coke. And the others looked at him in surprise and said, why aren't you drinking your family beer? He said, well, you men aren't drinking real beer, so I thought I wouldn't either.
We're talking to Oz Guinness, who came to America in 1984. It's never been the same since. When we come back, we'll talk him about that. And I'm Jack Crystal, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crystal, and we're with Oz Guinness, one of America's greatest thought leaders. Oz, how was it you came to America in 1984?
Well, I actually came across with my wife, who's American, although she was keen to stay in Europe at that stage. And we came just for 6 months to do some research on a book I was writing on America after I'd followed the rise of Reagan's second election and the influence of the religious right in that. And I had a most extraordinary experience of a direct call from God to come, leave Europe, and come and do whatever I show you to do in this country. So we sold our house, we were then living in Oxford, and moved over here and plunged into all sorts of things. I was at the Brookings Institution, but one of the first things I got into was a celebration of the First Amendment, which is called the Williamsburg Charter. And that's where I met the wonderful business leader who lives in your area, Alonzo McDonald. And it was one of the biggest celebrations of the First Amendment, celebrating the first 16 words of it, the so-called religious liberty clauses. And we had people from left to right who signed that charter, including two former presidents and the chief justice. And it was a significant milestone in the road to sustaining religious liberty today.
Oz, 30 years later, what's the greatest thing about America?
Well, I am a great believer in what St. Augustine said. You look at what a nation loves supremely. If it's noble, the thing it loves, the nation may be noble. And if it's healthy, the nation may be healthy. And I think there's no doubt, certainly as a European, not an American, that the thing America loves supremely is freedom. And the greatest daring achievement that the framers set in motion was to try and create a free society that could stay free forever. And I think we've got problems with that today. But to me, their attempt to create that sustainable freedom is the most daring and one of the worthiest parts of the great American experiment.
Speaking of freedom, you've authored and or edited 30-plus books, and one of them is entitled A Free People's Suicide, Sustainable Freedom and the American Future. Tell us the theme of that book.
Well, I'm trying to understand how the framers thought they could sustain freedom. Because from one side to the other, they all believed that was possible. They didn't give a name to it. Alexis de Tocqueville, the great French commentator, he calls it the reliance on the habits of the heart, a brilliant phrase. My own word for it is the golden triangle of freedom. And you can see this in all the framers. The idea, if you look at the three legs of the triangle, freedom requires virtue. Only a virtuous people, John Adams says, are capable of freedom. The second leg, that virtue of any sort requires faith of some sort. And the third leg, that faith of any sort requires freedom. And like the recycling triangle, it goes round and round. Freedom requires virtue, which requires faith, which requires freedom, which requires virtue, ad infinitum. Now, sadly, you've got an enormous amount of neglect of that idea of the framers, and, of course, some people, particularly in some of the university circles, attacking it is completely wrong. But the trouble is, even people who neglect it or attack it don't put anything in its place. And without it, there's no way in which American freedom can be sustained. And, of course, as you know, Jack, freedom never lasts. And so by ignoring it, people are failing to sustain the freedom that the framers set up.
Early in the book, Oz, one of the many threads that you keep running through it, you make a statement that the paradox is that the greatest enemy of freedom is freedom.
Well, you can look back through history and see that freedom, just as a matter of fact, doesn't last. Now, why is it? Well, there are three major reasons. One is freedom runs out into permissiveness and then license and undermines itself. The second is that freedom-loving people love freedom so much they want to be safe in their freedom, and they put such a stress on security and safety that they lose their freedom. Think today of the bumper sticker, One Nation Under Surveillance. And the third reason is that freedom-loving people so love freedom that they'll do anything, including things that contradict freedom, to fight for freedom. Think of things like the shame of Abu Ghraib. And you can see that the three major reasons why freedom never lasts have all been evident in American life in the last 10 to 15 years. In other words, it's much harder to sustain freedom than we realize. Freedom is the greatest enemy of freedom.
What do we have to change or adjust to ensure ongoing freedom?
Well, the first thing, of course, is we've got to understand freedom. And you can see today, I was at Oxford with the great Jewish philosopher Isaiah Berlin, who used to stress there is negative freedom and positive freedom. Negative freedom is freedom from colonial oppression, freedom from an addiction like alcoholism. Freedom from is very important, but it's only preliminary and foundational. You also need what he called positive freedom, freedom for, freedom to be. Now, if you look at American freedom today, in both conservative and liberal circles, most freedom is libertarian, all freedom from. The conservatives want the governments off their backs in terms of the economy. Liberal, the governments off their backs in terms of their bodies, and so on. Well, that's a negative freedom, and the simple fact is that negative freedom alone is quite literally unsustainable. So the understanding of freedom we have right now is deficient. But then you look at more practical things. To keep freedom going from generation to generation, you need civic education in the public schools, but we don't have that. In other words, it was always understood that everyone in a free society is born free, but not everyone's worthy of it or capable. They have to be educated for liberty. It was called liberal education or civic education. But that dropped out of the American public schools in the 1960s, and it's almost completely disappeared. You have some of the charter schools, some of the private schools, still keep it alive. But without it, the framers' notion of freedom will not be handed from generation to generation, and that's disastrous.
We're talking Oz Guinness. If you want to learn more, www.ttf.org. Oz, another one of your books is entitled The Global Public Square, and you talk about, you use the term soul freedom. What do you mean by soul freedom?
Well, that was the term used by Roger Williams. He was the first person in Western history, an Englishman who became the founder of Rhode Island, of course. He stressed that freedom of conscience, religious freedom, should be the right of everybody. Even great champions of freedom like John Locke and John Milton had restricted it. It was freedom for everyone except the atheists or except the Catholics or whatever. But Williams said, no, freedom of conscience, what he calls soul freedom, is freedom for everybody without exception. And, of course, that comes across into American history and gives the ideas behind the First Amendment, which is the most unique part of the American experiment, not separation of powers. Switzerland and other countries had that long earlier. But the First Amendment is the most unique part. Now, the tragedy is that brilliant position on freedom of conscience has been undermined by the culture warring of the last 50 years. And so America's in danger of squandering its greatest heritage. And at a moment when she should be a model for the world, a city on a hill, she's squandering her heritage and denying her own great background, but failing to show a better way before the world as a whole. Because we're in a world in which living with our deep differences is endangered as never before. It's a crucial issue. I think America has the best way forward, or did have, and we need to understand what Williams and many of the other great thinkers meant by the understanding, and then recapture that today.
We're talking Oz Guinness. When we come back, we'll ask him about his newest book that's due out in August, entitled Renaissance. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with a most amazing man, Oz Guinness, whose newest book is due out in August, entitled Renaissance. Oz, what do you want us to take from this book?
Well, there are many people who are looking around the situation today and sort of talk about decline and gloom and doom and gloom and so on. And this is an argument more particularly for Christians. The last two books were for all Americans in the public square. This is more particularly for Christians to say, trust in the proven track record of the power of the gospel. It changes individual lives, and it also changes culture. Now, of course, the First Amendment grants freedom for people of all faiths and none. And I've been one of the champions of that my whole life. But at the same time, we want to see a vibrant Christian faith taking its place in public life. And the book is about how the gospel, when it's lived out in practice, is always extremely powerful. So we don't have to try and be relevant and trendy and think the newer is true and all this sort of nonsense. We need actually just to trust the gospel at the very heart of our faith and live it out, and it will have the power to change culture.
Oz, in 1991, you and Alonzo start the Trinity Forum. What's the Trinity Forum?
Well, it was founded on the model of the Aspen Institute to try and bring back an understanding of the place of the Christian faith in Western civilization so that people could enter that so-called great conversation, which is the Western classics, and appreciate where we've come from. Because many people today, just as Goethe said, unless you know the last 3,000 years, you're living hand to mouth. And many people in America don't realize this extraordinary civilization we have, which owes so much to the Greeks and to the Romans, but above all to the Jews and to the Christians. And so we follow the Aspen model. There are no talks, no lectures, no sermons. Instead, people would have a curriculum of readings based on one part of the great conversation, say character. in the Western tradition and explore the readings from Plato or the Bible or Machiavelli or the founders and all that they thought, pro and con, and the place of character in public life. And so we had the privilege of having business leaders, political leaders, leaders from various parts of society discussing these great texts, never more than 25 or 30. And it was a very, very powerful way of acquainting people with a great conversation, challenging them to take their own part in it today.
It's still going on. I just got a notice the other day that the latest one is poems by Emily Dickinson, www.ttf.org. A few of my favorite Oz were Cry the Beloved Country by Ellen Patton, The Sunflower by Simon Wiesenthal, and Democracy in America by Tocqueville. What were some of your favorites?
Well, some of the earlier ones, like the one on William Wilberforce and his heroic example of the abolition movement and things like that. Or the very unusual one, The Sunflower, which is about Simon Wiesenthal on the whole question of forgiveness in the world. But I've got to say, that wonderful tradition of these small readings goes back to your near neighbor, Al MacDonald, who supported that vision from the beginning. And they've gone all over the world to leaders, challenging them to think and so on. And one of the latest things was a prison where the prisoners got together once, I think it was twice a month, to read these, and they had extraordinary impact on the prisoners and their thinking.
Can you tell our listeners about The Sunflower?
Well, that's an extraordinary story. Simon Wiesenthal, who later became the dedicated Jewish Nazi hunter, was in a concentration camp in Poland, near where he went to high school. And on a work detail one day, he was suddenly taken away, and he thought he was going to his death, but he was taken, as he discovered, into a hospital and then into a ward with one patient, a Nazi officer, hideously burnt, obviously dying, who reached out a skeletal hand to him and said, "I want to confess to you as a Jew." And he told him about the Jews he'd killed, how he'd grown up a Catholic and then got into the SS. And then he says, "Will you hear my confession?" And he reaches out a hand, and Wiesenthal brushes it away and then raises the question, "What should I have done? What could I have done? What would you have done?" And then he asked 50 world leaders to give their responses. And I found it not only fascinating but chilling to see how many agreed with him that there was absolutely no forgiveness at all to that Nazi officer. Now, the clearest who argued for forgiveness was Desmond Tutu and Martin Mahdi of Chicago, the great theologian. And one of them argues that forgiveness frees us from the past. The burdens of what we've done wrong in the past are cut off when we're forgiven by God. And secondly, forgiveness by God and our fellow humans forgives us in terms of the future, so we don't carry that burden, that baggage, into the future. So forgiveness gives you the faith that underscores the second chance. And as we both know so well, all of us as humans have failed here and there. We've done that which is wrong, we're ashamed of, we're shabby, or whatever. And I think forgiveness is a wonderful thing. And that story, I know it set off fascinating and furious debates, including among atheists in Europe, who said, now, do we have a ground for a similar view of forgiveness? And many have had to admit they don't. But in the good news of Jesus, you have an incredible foundation for a very powerful and very practical view of forgiveness.
A little aside, Oz, a Desmond Tutu story. One time President Reagan had lunch with Desmond Tutu. Came back to the Oval Office, they said, "President, how was lunch with Desmond Tutu?" He said, "So-so." All right, Oz.
I was waiting for more.
You've addressed audiences from the British House of Commons to the U.S. Congress to the St. Petersburg Parliament and to the Chinese Academy of the Social Sciences. And when I heard you speak recently, you used a phrase I'd never heard before, the crunch generation. What is the crunch generation?
Well, it's the word used of the generation now rising to adulthood, because in the global era, many of the huge issues of the world have gone global. Economic, technological, environmental, nuclear, many other things. and they're raising issues which are going to provide a crunch in the lifetime of this rising generation. And if these issues are answered well, humankind's in for calm sailing. And if they're not answered well, they're answered not at all through drift, then the world's in really serious trouble. So I challenge the rising generation to really be able to think globally and act locally, but to know how to take on these huge issues in very responsible ways.
Another quote from you is, "Our modern world is a world without windows." Please.
Well, that's actually, I often use the phrase, and I hope no one thinks it's mine. It comes from my own mentor, now friend, Peter Berger. And he is describing the effects of the so-called secularization of the world. Someone else called it, we're roofed in. Max Weber, the great sociologist, said secularized people are tone deaf. They just don't pick up the music or the spheres that other people hear. And you can see that's one of the features of our modern world. In other words, in our world today, the unseen is unreal. In the past, in the traditional world, the unseen was actually very real. It was more real than the seen world, and people understood things as practical as business and farming and sex in the light of the unseen world, whether they were Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, or whatever. But in our modern world, the unseen is unreal. And we're locked into this, Peter Berger calls it, the world without windows. And we're impoverished because of it. Even Nietzsche called that the acoustic illusion. We all know that we don't hear certain sounds that bats and bears and so on pick up easily. That doesn't mean those sounds aren't real. It just means our human ears are not on the right frequency. And you can see that many modern people are secularized, and they just don't pick up the music of the spheres by which Christians, Jews, and others orchestrate their lives. But modern people are tone deaf, roofed in, and living in a world without windows.
We're talking to Oz Guinness. When we come back, we'll ask him the three great questions of the 21st century. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Oz Guinness, who believes that the golden triangle is that freedom requires virtue, virtue requires faith of some sort, and faith of any sort requires freedom. If you want to learn more, www.ttf.org. Oz, I heard you give a speech recently, and you talked about the three great questions of the 21st century. Please.
Well, the idea goes back, actually, to Otto von Bismarck, the German chancellor, who, when he was dying, was asked what would be the decisive factor in the 20th century. And he answered famously, it's the fact that Americans speak English. In other words, when Britain declined, the vacuum was filled not by the victory of a European conflict, but by what became the American century. And people are asking in the same spirit, what are the key ideas, questions shaping the 21st? And I'm moved by the fact that faith is involved in all three of them. The first great question, will Islam modernize peacefully? A monumental challenge for Muslims and for the world. Not impossible, but things aren't going terribly well at that front at the moment. The second great question, which faith will replace Marxism in China? Everyone knows the party is in power, the Communist Party, but the ideology is hollow and dead. And the Chinese are discussing which faith. Will it be materialism, nationalism, Confucianism, Buddhism, or could it be in the 20 years' time the Christian faith will be the majority faith? But the third question comes closer to home. Will our Western civilization, including the leadership of America, sever or recover its roots, which, of course, are Jewish and Christian primarily? Now, that's an extremely important question, not only for the West, but also for the whole world. And so you can see the integrity and effectiveness of faith is one of the key factors for our human future.
Oz, you have a phenomenal way of answering skeptics' questions. How did you learn to do this?
Well, thank you very much. I watched and heard many times Francis Schaeffer, who was the best person-to-person Christian advocate that I've ever heard. And I learned a huge amount of him. First of all, you love people enough to listen to them. And often watching him, his eyes would well with tears as he got into people's stories and really began to understand where they were coming from. And a lot of Christian talk is just talk without the love that has to precede it, which, of course, you see in Jesus himself. But then secondly, he was brilliant, Francis Schaeffer, taking people's ideas and seeing that, as in the scriptures, you press them out towards the logic of their assumptions. So you take Elijah talking to the prophets of Baal. He's totally outnumbered. He gives them the first choice. If Baal is God, follow Baal, he says to the people, because he knows that Baal is not God. And in the same way, some Christians sort of thunder back against atheists and others, when the problem with atheism is atheism, and you press it out gently and respectfully to see where it leads to and has led to in the last 200 years, and it makes atheists rethink. And I think that's the sort of style we need to recapture with lots of love and great respect whenever we talk to people.
In an earlier segment, you talked about the civic restoration needed in America today. Can you expound on that some more?
Well, that's a very practical thing. We need two practical things. I mentioned earlier the restoration of civic education. You can see today, they say, the modern view of history, which is bottom-up rather than top-down, often excludes the founding fathers and excludes the brilliance of their ideas. Now, they had blind spots. You take, say, their treatment of slaves or of Native Americans or sometimes of women. They had real blind spots, which we're aware of today. But then to respond to that by throwing out baby bathwater and all, and forgetting the areas such as freedom of conscience, I mentioned earlier, where they were brilliant and almost nearly perfectly right from the beginning, well, to throw that out is just absolute folly. So we've got to restore civic education, an understanding of the unum, a pluribus unum, the early American motto. We need to know what are the uniting first principles that combine, bring together all Americans, despite the diversity we have. So we've got to restore these things, what the framers founded and intended. What are the uniting first principles of the American experiment? Without this, the American experiment will inevitably decline, as it's doing today. The second area we've got to tackle, I'll just mention, is a reopening of the civil public square, which after 50 years of culture warring is often freezing over. And that, again, is disastrous for America.
I quote you, "The church has to be in, but not of, the world." Please.
That goes back to the words of our Lord, of course, in his great prayer in John 17. But you can see when the church is in the culture and of it, it's just worldly and has no power at all. And that's true of much of the American church today. But when it tries to be pure and it's not in the culture at all, it's so not of it, it's utterly irrelevant. And the challenge is to be in it, engaged, but not of it, decisively Christian. So the church has a social tension with culture, which actually becomes culturally transforming and creative. And that's what we need to regather today. The terrible fact is the Christians are a huge majority still. But you have tiny minorities who have far more influence in American public life than Christians do, because Christians are not engaged as salt and light in the way Jesus called us to do and be.
Another quote, "To believe in God is to let God be God." Please.
In other words, we've really got to practice the faith. And you can see today that in our modern world, through the brilliance of technology and science and management through metrics and other things, we've reached the mentality, you almost don't need God. You can put a man on the moon, you can market a car, you can grow a church. We know all the methods how to do it. And we're so sophisticated, we can almost beat what Jesus said, man does not live by bread alone, quoting Deuteronomy. We can almost today live without God by science, technology, management alone. And we've got to remember the strength of faith in Jesus is when we let God be God and we practice the gospel and we live the truth. And then it becomes very powerful and salty and light-bearing and culture-shaping.
Over the last year, watching Pope Francis, what's impressed you the most about him?
Well, what's impressed, I think, many people, including the skeptics and atheists, is his attempt to be as simple and straightforward and as grace-filled as Jesus himself was. In other words, not to speak on behalf of a great, powerful institution, but to be as close to the way of Jesus himself. And, of course, that should be true of all followers of Jesus, whether Roman Catholics or Evangelicals or Orthodox or Pentecostals or whatever. As we live the way of Jesus, that's the way we show the truth of Jesus in practice, and that's what appeals to people. And Pope Francis is, like his great namesake, St. Francis, in doing that so wonderfully.
As if a listener says, "Oz, I can't talk like you. I'm not that smart. What can each of us do to improve the world?"
Well, I'm not sure I'm that smart, but I would say, Jack, think globally and act locally. Put that in Christian terms. We should each live out our calling. We should think and pray about the whole world. But we can't respond to the whole world. We can't save the whole world. We can't manage the whole world. Our engagement with the world is through our own separate callings. You're a business person. I'm a writer and journalist. Other people are homemakers or public school teachers or lawyers or computer scientists or whatever. And as we learn to live the whole of our lives as a matter of faithful callings, in our families, in our work, through every sphere we touch, then we truly become salt and light. And together, we can do what none of us alone can do. So that idea of thinking and praying globally, but acting through our own callings, I think that's one of the keys to really making a difference in the world today.
Speaking of praying, can you lead us, Oz, in a closing prayer this evening?
I'd be happy to. Our Father, we thank you that in a world of huge challenges and immense complexity and considerable chaos, that you are sovereign and you are still reaching out to people to draw them to you and to show all of us how to live in a way that expresses your truth and brings your love and grace to all our neighbors. Lord, help us to love our neighbors as ourselves, because we love you first and foremost. This we pray in your great name. Amen.
Oz Guinness, what a joy it is to listen to you. What a treasure. What a great thought leader. Please keep up the great work.
Well, my great privilege. Thanks for having me, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasulo. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.